You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
Today on From Embers, you'll hear my conversation with two organizers from Anti-Police Power Surrey, or APPS, a grassroots organization in so-called British Columbia committed to building collective resistance to police and the systems of power and domination they uphold, capitalism, colonialism, and white supremacy. APPS organizes community events and education, marches and rallies, and direct action with the goals of tearing down police power, building up the collective power of communities affected by policing, and transforming our society and ourselves so that in times of crisis we can rely on each other for safety, support, healing, and justice. Just a note that Alliance Against Displacement is mentioned in the interview several times, which is another grassroots group organizing with communities facing displacement in BC. Some listeners might remember my previous interview with members of Alliance Against Displacement about the schoolhouse squat in Nanaimo, BC several months ago. If you haven't heard the episode but are interested to hear more about homeless, Indigenous, and working class people building collective power, struggling for housing autonomy, and building a world against the police, I suggest you check it out. That's enough for me. Here's the interview.
Hi, my name is Teresa Detling, and I'm an organizer with APPS, Anti-Police Power Surrey.
And I am Karina. I am Latina who grew up most of my life in on Treaty 1 territory in what is now Winnipeg. And I have been an organizer with APPS for about 6 or 7 months now.
To start, I guess, could you tell me a bit about your context in Surrey, or I guess, yeah, for our listeners who aren't super familiar, what Surrey is like and what are some of the things that people are facing as you're living and organizing there?
To sort of understand the context of Surrey, I think one of the most important things for people to know is that it's an area, it's a city that has a population that's majority racialized folks. For example, there's 540,000 people in Surrey and 43% are immigrants. Mostly from India, the Philippines, and China. I think that's really important to point out because I think it's pretty probably clear to your listeners that non-white people tend to be the targets of police. And I suspect that that's the underlying systemic factor which makes Surrey so highly policed is that white settlers in Canada just are afraid of Indigenous people and racialized people. And so they feel this need to surveil and control them more so than they do white settlers. So that's the first point. And then what's going on in Surrey is very similar to what's happening in the rest of the Lower Mainland in that there's a massive housing shortage. So for example, in Surrey, there's a less than 1% vacancy rate. And so what we have in Surrey is, there's nowhere really to rent. For example, if you were go to look at one suite, you would be competing with probably about 100 people on average for one suite. This is causing the homeless population to increase more and more each year. because what's happening is that landlords are picking basically what they consider to be the best of the best for tenants. And that translates into people who have the most money, right? And so that's feeding into and creating the homeless population is this underlying housing shortage, which is caused because the current government and the previous governments haven't really been building public housing. In the 90s, the BC government in British Columbia was building 10,000 units of social housing a year. And then a Liberal government was elected and they completely stopped. So when we're talking about the housing shortage today in Surrey and the Lower Mainland generally, it's the result of literally decades of corruption on the part, I would say corruption on the part of the political parties that have been elected in British Columbia. And so where APPS comes in is that in Surrey is where we're interested in organizing, because Surrey is a place where the police, as they do in all areas, harass, brutalize, and murder people. It's just more extreme in Surrey for a variety of reasons, which Karina could speak to.
Thanks, Teresa. I think one other thing maybe that we can add to what you were saying is that there are certain parts of Surrey that are a bit harder hit by like these skyrocketing rent rates, with Guildford being one kind of geographic area that's especially hard hit. And just to kind of paint a picture, about 43% of renters in the area spend more than a third of their income on rent. And so it really does paint a stark picture about how highly likely it is for people to face this risk of becoming homeless, and that many people are about a paycheck away from experiencing that same kind of condition. And we also have the largest detachment in the country, and it grows larger every year. So about a third of the city of Surrey's resources goes towards funding the RCMP. So that comes out to about $156 million a year that aren't going to other social services. Much of the kind of the justification for this budget and for continuing to increase the budget is this fear around crime and around drug related and gang related crime in Surrey, which really flies in the face of a lot of the kind of findings we've been finding, not just in Surrey, but across Canada, where drug related offenses are decreasing. And so is gang related violence.
Why is your group against the police?
So I guess it'll be helpful to describe Anti-Police Power Surrey a little bit more. One of the big inspirations for APPS convening last year was the immense amount of police brutality that two specific social groups in Surrey face. One of these groups being homeless communities and the other one being BIPOC communities, so Black, Indigenous, and POC communities, especially South Asian youth. And there is this incredible swirling panic around gang violence and drug-related violence that grips a lot of people, and it means that low-income, homeless, racialized youth are targeted predominantly. But it really takes away from the core issues of why we're seeing people joining gangs, for example, or people using drugs. And it's an issue of poverty. It's an issue of housing related. Like there not being enough housing, the rent prices skyrocketing, all of these things point to a much broader social context that's really not talked about. And the dominant narrative in Surrey is that we need the police in order to maintain social order and to keep one another safe. And what APPS does is we draw on decades of work that Black, Indigenous, working class activists, poets, scholars, revolutionaries have done in kind of how would you say, like unearthing the social function of the police, which is about upholding the interests of property owners and business owners. And so we're a coalitional group. Basically, a lot of people from Alliance Against Displacement are part of APPS, but there's also people who have lived in Surrey, at least a part of their lives, who have been drawn to anti-police work in some aspect. And because there isn't a lot of work in Surrey around this, APPS has been kind of an opportunity for people to explore or to challenge kind of the power of the police a little bit more. Yeah, and I guess like part of my reason for wanting to join APPS is because growing up in a low-income neighborhood, the police have always been around, like the sounds of sirens have been normalized for years and years, and it's not something that I questioned until very recently. But I'm really interested in how policing upholds white supremacy and what white supremacy as an ideology does to racialize people and keeping us small and constraining our imaginations for the future. And one of the unique things about APPS is that we have an opportunity to work with young people and to help show them that they're leaders in this struggle to challenge the power of the police.
So I'm also a member of the Alliance Against Displacement, but what drew me to APPS was my experiences with the police throughout my life. I am a white cis woman, and so I do have white privilege, but even in Canada, because I'm also, I grew up poor and from the lower classes, I've always had negative experiences with the police. And in many ways, the police have sort of shaped the trajectory of my family's future and past. When my father was a teenager, he ran away from home because he was being abused by his father. He was arrested for theft and thrown in jail with adults. So he was about 15 and he was sent to an adult prison where he was brutally gang raped. And so he left prison incredibly traumatized. And it impacted his life in such a way that he was an alcoholic and he was abusive to my mother and my siblings. I was the last one born, so to speak, so I didn't get the worst of it. And so these types of experiences I've seen my whole life, where when you're in a low-income community, the police don't seem to come in to help. They always seem to make things worse. For example, with me, when I called the police when I was being abused by my partner, a file was opened on me and I was investigated by social services as an unfit parent. And so these are highly personal experiences. And then as I became involved with the Alliance Against Displacement and I started to learn about things like anti-capitalist and capitalism and how these capitalist systems work to maintain a social order wherein the majority of the population has the least amount of the wealth. And so for me, these personal experiences of the lived experiences of seeing the harm that the police do, especially to low-end communities, but then also having a little bit of a political understanding that it's not just a coincidence that I've had negative experiences with the police. It's actually tied to a larger system. So for me, APPS provided an opportunity for me to take feelings of frustration, of being treated unfairly, and to put that into action to try to change things. And that's what APPS seeks to do with all of the people we connect with, whether it's people who are in homeless camps or racialized youth or just youth in general, right? Is we want to get out there, we want to connect with people who've had those negative experiences with the police and introduce them to the history of the police and of how the police were set up initially, basically in Canada, to ensure that all of the Indigenous nations were dispossessed of their lands. So they were never set up as a force of justice. There was no crime, right? They were set up to ensure that white settlers could get control of the land in Canada. And that sort of underlying historic element continues to manifest itself. So it's about trying to engage with people who've had these harmful experiences with the police and give them the tools educationally to then challenge it. And what the challenging of the police will look like will depend sort of on the community we're interacting with and where they want to go with it.
Could you talk a bit more about some of the goals of apps, whether that's in like the short or medium term, or the longer term as well. I'm curious how you see the work that apps does as contributing to broader struggles or larger goals.
So we do have, I guess, a variety of different objectives and strategies, kind of long term and shorter term. Our long term strategy or vision is that we see a future without the police existing. Of course, we recognize, though, that that's something that cannot exist without also taking part in a complete social transformation of our social relations, as well as the way that we see ourselves and everyday interactions. And so it's part of this, I suppose, the police abolition and fighting against the police in Surrey is something we see as a wedge issue into a broader anti-colonial and anti-capitalist struggle. And the way that we kind of conceive of these two struggles is that they are deeply connected with one another, but they cannot be subsumed. And so they have different protagonists, in that Indigenous people are the protagonists of anti-colonial struggle, and working class people are the protagonists of anti-capitalist struggle. And with the work that we do, we hope to kind of identify the strategic points of unity between these two kind of protagonists, and also in that kind of highlight the similarities in the struggle that they face, because yes, they're different, and the ways in which settler colonialism harms Indigenous people is different than the way in which capitalist alienation impacts working class people. But if we draw from revolutionaries like Frantz Fanon, for instance, we are reminded that at the end of the day, these different forms of oppression are all the same, because we are talking about the same object, and that object is man. It's all of us. And so APPS fights back against all forms of power, which includes state-sanctioned hard power or physical force that the police wield over our lives and over specific social groups, like we had mentioned, homeless people and racialized and Indigenous Black youth. But it's also about fighting against the soft power of the police, which the police secure through public relations, for example. And it's kind of these like ideological claws that the police have over us and our imaginations about what the future can hold, and our ability to work towards this future without them existing. And yeah, I mean, we're strongly influenced by organizations in the US, including A World Without Police. And because we have these long-term kind of goals, it's helpful to have like more concrete tactical approaches to getting there. And inspired by A World Without Police are these four different kind of approaches we have. So we have defund the police so we can invest in real community-led solutions. We have disarm police and prevent the acquisition of additional weapons and surveillance technologies. We have disband police units, teams, and task forces whenever possible. And we've also come up with a fourth D that is particularly relevant here in Surrey, and it's that we work to drive police out of our schools, community spaces, and social services. And this is really important in the Surrey context, where police infiltrate all aspects of life and the lines between cops and community are constantly being blurred. Yeah, and with that being said, like this past year that we've convened has been an opportunity for us to really experiment and get a sense of what the situation is like here in Surrey. And it's challenged us to think hard about these four Ds that we've initially identified. Because the nitty-gritty and the detailed ways in which we are able to meet what each of these four Ds is going to vary so much depending on where the consciousness of the social base is. And in order for us to even know that, we need to be building relationships with these social bases. And that's been a huge part of the work that we've been doing in this past year, is really trying to get apps, like more connected with these different communities. And we've been doing that in a variety of different ways, including going to high school classrooms and presenting with high school students about the social function of the police, so that we can also hear kind of what their perspectives are about policing in Surrey and more broadly. And we've also been doing a lot of support work with tent cities, including a tent city that exists here in Surrey called Sanctuary Tent City, where a lot of the people who were once living on the Wally Strip last year before it got disbanded are now living.
Can you tell me a bit more about some of the actions and organizing that APPS has been doing over the past year, and if there's any particular things that you want to highlight or that stand out to you personally?
In the past year, what we've been trying to do is intervening with what we call copaganda. So like, for example, in Surrey, they have these events called like Coffee with a Cop. And so what we've been doing is organizing events that are family friendly and involve, instead of coffee with a cop, it's coffee with apps, where we can come and talk about ways we can challenge the police, and doing so challenge the notion that there's a pervasive idea in society that when you step outside the lines and challenge the police, you're doing something wrong. So what we want to do is with our coffee nights is to challenge that idea that good people can come together and talk about the ways in which the police impact people's lives negatively. And we organized a rally against policing in the lead up to the last municipal election, where crime was the number one election issue, and politicians were tripping over each other to present tough on crime policies and promised increased policing. And we have been putting on public education events. Like, we've hosted a number of panels and events, and we've also participated in a number of panels and events. And we have been engaging with youth a lot, as Karina was saying, through our workshops and our coffee nights. And what we've been trying to do too also is support the homeless organizing. So what happens with homeless people everywhere, but in Surrey is a prime example, is they'll find a safe place to set up camps, and then the police will go in and break them up in particularly brutal and violent ways. And so what we've been trying to do is create an awareness that this is going on. So for example, when we work with a camp, if they get notice that the police are coming in, we set up a press conference, and we bring in supporters so that there's witnesses, right? Because the police act a lot different when people are watching and when things are being recorded. And so just being that presence there for not just for support, but to record and to challenge what's going on makes a big difference. We also held a memorial for all of the people who have died on the streets. Last year, in Surrey, the police did a huge sort of militaristic action where they went to a street known as the Surrey Strip, where over 100 homeless people had been living for a number of years, and they completely cleared it. And in doing so, they put out a narrative that they had solved homelessness. And they put out a narrative in the press that they had solved homelessness and people got homes and there was no more homeless problem in Surrey, to the point that they even had an event where they gave a medal to a police officer who coordinated that effort, to congratulate him because for their narrative, they're saying there's no more homelessness. But in fact, what happened was the people on that strip, the vast majority of them just went to different parts of the city. And they remained homeless. So they set up camps in different areas of the city and were sort of split up. Since being split up, a lot of people have died, because the truth is when homeless people are all living in one spot, they can provide a lot of community support, overdose prevention, and they can also intervene if someone's overdosing. So the act of splitting up the homeless camp didn't just displace people, but it actually caused a lot of death. And so we really want to try to support this particular group. For example, last night we attended a city council meeting that was held in Surrey because a group of people in Surrey were objecting to a supportive housing development that was being with the Surrey is planning on implementing. And so we went there to speak up for two reasons, because supportive housing is actually what we call, it's really just another form of prison. So when people hear supportive housing, they think, wow, that sounds like it's going to help people. But it's a highly controlled environment where people are treated essentially like prisoners. They're institutionalized just for being poor. And so we went there to challenge the narrative that building supportive housing is appropriate. We wanted to talk about how all housing is needed, and that it's not about supportive housing, but it's just about building housing in general for people. And then having supports, different types of supports that people can choose to engage with or not engage with. And then also in general too, just to challenge the notion that homeless people are dangerous, because what the police do in Surrey is they really perpetuate this idea that homeless people are dangerous and need to be managed by the police. And unfortunately, some residents of Surrey they've taken that up. And so it's really about challenging these narratives, and so that we can start to think about other ways the community can support each other when it comes to things like property crime.
And because I've done a lot of work with the workshops in high schools, I kind of just want to talk a little bit more about that, because I think it's quite cool. It's really fascinating, honestly, to hear all these different students talk about the police. And I remember just last week, for example, bringing up this question of what if we imagine a world without police, and a student raised his hand and was like, we can't possibly have young people making decisions for themselves because they don't know enough, and we need adults to be making decisions on behalf of these young people, on behalf of us. And that's really telling. And you know, throughout the workshops, I think it's a really good source of like social investigation, and getting a sense of like where people's consciousness is at. And it's also really exciting to see people open up to this possibility of a future without police, and to connect it with their own lives, and seeing how police in schools, for example, or police coming to their parties, for example, kind of contributes to like fissuring within their social groups, and that it promotes snitch culture. And it's honestly such a it's a challenging space to be in, because you have to kind of navigate a lot of conflicting views sometimes, but still kind of making sure that everyone feels respected and comfortable enough to contribute what they have to say. But all that being said, one of the best things that has come from that is that we're able to build relationships with these young people. And now what we're going to do is we're going to get them to come out to our space, like come out to the office, because we have an office that we do a lot of our work out of, and figure out ways to plug them into this organizing work. Of course, respecting like where their capacities are at and where their interests lie, but ultimately coming back to this core principle that we as apps have about having the social base really, and having the social base and their spontaneous energies be kind of like the guiding force for the work that we do, and we kind of help steer it along by, for example, political consciousness raising and things like that. But ultimately, that leadership and that spark is coming from them.
What's really interesting about all these workshops is that we haven't really had anyone give a concrete example of how the police have intervened in their lives in a positive way. So when we do these workshops, we'll get students who will actually oftentimes disclose stories of how the police have been particularly harmful to their family or to their community in general. And while there might be other students who will say, yeah, but we need the police, they can't really give any examples of how the police really make things, conditions any better. And I think that's really important, is that creating a space just to talk about the fact that things aren't working in our capitalist society, and that we can change them, right? We can think differently.
And the last thing I guess that maybe we can bring up is the fact that there is a detention center that's opening up here in Surrey. It's been postponed. It was supposed to open up in the summer, to my understanding, but it's been pushed to, I think, early next year, something like that. But right now, we don't have any organizing happening in this area. And of course, challenging the need for borders goes hand in hand with challenging the police in our communities. And so I kind of just want to put that out there, that if anyone is interested in organizing specifically around detention centers, to get in touch with us, because this is something that, for capacity reasons mainly, we haven't really touched on, but is something that is really critical to our work.
Could you describe for a bit what day-to-day organizing with APPS is like, or like how you make decisions and relate to each other and people within your social base as well?
We do meet every other Sunday from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Alliance Against Displacement and Fuerza Migrante office in a geographic area in Surrey called Wally. So those meetings are open to anyone who's interested in coming, and we often have people that we've never met before coming to meetings, which is always really exciting. And so typically the way that these meetings work is that we have a bottom liner who usually takes the initiative to chair that meeting, and we together come up with a list of items that we will discuss at that meeting as like priorities that we want to focus on for the next two weeks to a month. Yeah, there isn't really like any particular tendency in the group. Like there are anarchists in the group. There are communists in the group. There's people who don't have any political affiliation in the group, and so it's meant to be a coalitional space. And really, we're just trying to open up an opportunity for people to bring up ideas that they have, and we try to make this as comfortable as a space as possible, so people can kind of like work through their thoughts, and we delegate tasks accordingly to see things through. Yeah, I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it totally did. I always find it interesting to hear about sort of the practical, like how people do the stuff that they're doing, or
yeah. But yeah, how do we form relationships with members of the social base? I think, at least for the youth, the workshops right now is a really big way in which we're trying to do that. Getting them familiar with our faces and helping to build a bit of trust with us so that people feel more comfortable coming out to events or coming out to the space to use this and to do things that they want to do but need space to do that. And then in terms of homeless residents, our support work with the tent cities is a big way in which we do that as well. Many of the people who are with Alliance Against Displacement have had years-long relationships with people who lived on the Surrey Strip. And those are relationships that have been kind of nurtured and incubated over a long period. And yeah, showing support at this more recent sanctuary tent city, and making an effort to be as reliable as possible and to provide resources when possible, when they need support for press conferences and things like that, are ways that we try to help build trust.
We don't believe you, cause we the people are still here in the rear, yo, we don't need you. You ain't a killing off good young nigga move. When we get hungry, we eat the same fucking food, the ramen noodle. This simple voodoo is so maniacal, reliable to pull a juju. The irony is that this bad bitch in my lap, she don't tell me she make money, she don't study that. She gon' give it to me, ain't gon' tell me none of that. She gon' take the brain away the plane she spit on that. The doors and signs with it, don't try to rhyme with it. VH1 has a show that you can waste your time with. Guilty pleasures take the edge off reality. And for a salary, I'll probably do that just sporadically. The OG Gucci boots are smitten with iguanas. The IRS piranhas see a nigga getting common.
in the hood, living in a fishbowl. Gentrify here, now it's not a shithole. Trendsetter, I know my shit's cold. Hand sentiment because I ain't so cold. But hey, all you black folks, you must go. All you Mexicans, you must go. And all you poor folks, you must go. Muslims and gays, boy, we hate your ways. So all you bad folks, you must go.
The fog and the smog of the media, the logs, false narratives of guys that came up against the odds. We're not just nigga rappers with the bars. It's kismet that we're cosmic with the stars. You bastards overlooking street art, better yet street smart, but you keep us on the charts. Some of the fucking numbers and your statistician. Fuck y'all know about true competition. Just like the AO picture on there talking about he hitting. The only one who's hitting are the ones that's currently spitting. We got your Missy smitten, rubbing on a little kitten, dreaming of a world that's equal for women with no division. Boy, I tell you, that's vision. Like Tony Romo when he hitting with it. The tribe be the best in a division. Shaheed Muhammad cut it with precision. Who can come back years later, still hit the shot? Still, I'm trying to move you off the fucking block. Babylon, blood clot. Droop on your head, Todd.
All you black folks, you must go. All you Mexicans, you must go. Folks, you must go.
I'm curious, with some of your like public rallies or public events, what kind of reception from people have you had, and also what kind of reception have you had from the police in Surrey, if any?
So I haven't been around for too long, but the one rally that I remember was well attended, and it was primarily racialized people, not just from Surrey, but from other parts of mainland Vancouver who had come to support this rally that we had put on to kind of bring attention to the lack of need that we have for the police. And the police were, for the most part, not in our faces at all. Like, marshalling went well. Generally, it's quite common for the police to just kind of take on that that traffic control role in the rallies that I've experienced. So there hasn't really been too much tension in that regard. But when we go out to other rallies to see what the kind of popular discourse is and things like that, we also don't face all that much tension from people who are there in favor of the message that's being given. And I wonder, and that makes us think a bit about how polarized, I guess, residents in Surrey are around issues of policing. There was an event that I'm thinking of that happened, I think, in May or something, and it was to speak out against drug and gang-related violence in Surrey. And one of the big messages that they had was to call for more boots on the ground, so for more RCMP on the ground. They were also calling for more surveillance in schools and a flurry of other repressive means in order to kind of keep young people and families safe and away from gangs. And a group of us were there with our signs, and at first, like, we were getting some kind of scowls and like some side eyes from people, but we didn't really face too much conflict for them. And then near the end of this rally, because we were holding up signs and other people were holding up signs with very different messaging, we were actually invited to go and take a picture with them. So I think that kind of says something about the general climate in Surrey about how people feel about the police.
Sorry, I just want to make sure I understand. Were you saying that, like, even at rallies where people had gathered in support of the police, still among the people there was like sympathetic responses to some of the stuff you were saying? Or
I mean, it wasn't even sympathetic. I think it was more so apathy feels like the wrong word, but maybe just neutral. I think like there was some skepticism, I think, among some of the people at that particular rally that I was recalling, but there really wasn't any like outright animosity towards us.
That's interesting.
And I wonder if it's because of the composition of Surrey, because the majority of people in Surrey are working class and racialized folks, that I almost get the sense that it's that they've only been given one narrative. They've only been given one reality. And even within that reality, they recognize that they are not really being treated fairly, but it's not knowing that there's other ways to move through the world or to understand ourselves and the type of societies we can build. So I think that might be the case, because I know, like, for example, in Maple Ridge, it's not like that. There's very violent vigilantes in Maple Ridge who do threaten people who show up to support people that are homeless and things like that. And that, I think that speaks to the difference in class composition in Maple Ridge.
It also makes me wonder about whether this decision not to be so outwardly violent towards us, like the police's decision not to be so outwardly violent towards us, is similar to like a public relations decision about, wanting to really emphasize that they are a source of safety for the community and that people have a right to dissent if they so wish. That kind of plays into this broader narrative about maybe the Canadian police being more benevolent than their American counterparts, for instance. But we do ultimately want to emphasize, though, that BC in particular has, I think, the highest number of police-related deaths in all of Canada. And just in March or so, there were two people who were murdered by the police in a supposedly hostage situation where one of the people who had been killed was holding someone else hostage. Because the police control the flow of information when it comes to police-involved deaths, they're able to kind of shape the narrative. And that's kind of what we saw in that situation where these two people, whose names are Nona and Randy, it was framed in this way that it was because one of the people had shot the hostages, and then something happened that wasn't clear for many weeks. And it wasn't until about May or something like that, like a month and a half later, that this independent kind of investigation agency came out with this report that in fact it was the police who had killed these two people. And then there was no follow-up after that.
What kind of public relations or community policing strategies have you found the police employing, and are there ways that APPS is trying to interfere with or disrupt that?
I think one of the most glaring examples is the Surrey Strip. So as I was saying earlier, there was a street where over 100 homeless people had set up camp for years. And what the police did was they announced to the public that they had created this task force. The police were now not, in addition to being police, they were going to intervene as like mental health workers. So all of the stories that you see published about the Surrey Strip, it talks about how the police that were working on the Surrey Strip were a unique kind of police. They were the type of police that wasn't dominating or authoritative, but they were the type of police that were going in to try to support people and to help people. And when we went to talk to people at the Strip, what we found was the exact opposite, that the police were incredibly violent and threatening. It wasn't unusual for people to just get arrested for no reason, just to sort of like hassle them. It was really difficult to organize on the Strip, because when organizers would go to the Strip, the police would actually follow them up and down the Strip as they tried to talk to people. And so we found out what would happen afterwards is that anyone who talked to the organizers was then harassed by the police. Their tent was thrown, their tent was like confiscated and thrown in the garbage, and they were threatened with being like arrested for like minor things and put in and incarcerated. So when the Surrey Strip was being cleared, a homeless person told one of our organizers that she was having her items confiscated by the police to be thrown in the trash, and she had an EpiPen. And she said to the bylaw officer and the police person that was present there, I need my EpiPen because it's a life-saving medical device, right? And they looked at her and laughed and threw it into the bin, right? And as if, and she said, you know, as if to say, you know, her they wanted her to die in a sense, right? So what was relayed in the media was that the police had gone in and kindly and benevolently taken all these homeless people and ushered them into shelters and housing. And that not only did that not happen, but it was a violent militaristic operation. And it was really interesting because what they did was they invited the media in for the first day or two, I believe. I think it was the first day. And they acted very like kind and sort of benevolent. And then they said to the media, oh, well, your presence is stressing out the homeless people and upsetting them. So now we're going to continue clearing the strip without the media there, because it upsets people to have all this media watching them, right? And then after the media were gone, it became incredibly violent. There was no trace of compassion from the police officers.
The other thing too, is that the police here seem to use community events as another way to kind of get their hooks into the community and really nurture this narrative about them being part of the community. There was this really large fair-like event that happened, I think, on May 11th, as part of this week-long celebration about the police, or specifically about the RCMP. And yeah, all of these things kind of paint the police in a kind of benevolent light. But it also kind of justifies this sort of layered policing model that we see a lot in Surrey. And the layered policing model is one that uses not just the police to constrain, repress, and surveil poor people, homeless people, and BIPOC people, but it's also volunteers from the community. It's also social workers, it's health workers, it's all of these different members of the public sector that are kind of used as a way to reinforce, like, ultimately control over people.
What do you find are some of your biggest challenges with the organizing that you're doing with APPS?
Again, speaking from my experience with young people especially, it's kind of grappling with reasons about why folks don't organize or don't think that that's an option for them. And in one class, I asked this question outright. And many of the people brought up concerns about what impact organizing with an anti-police power organization will have on their future job prospects. And other Surrey residents are afraid of being brutalized, for instance, as a result of their organizing. And so that's challenging. Like, it tells me something about like the context that we're in and how people feel like they don't have options but to just kind of like go with the flow and not disrupt anything. And the challenge there also becomes like one of the more exciting parts of this work, in helping kind of like spark people's imaginations about a future that they would want to help build, you know, that we have no idea what it'll look like, but absolutely needs the leadership of oppressed people in order to be viable and to work. So that's one of them for sure. And I think another heartening aspect of working with APPS is learning that people don't seem as polarized about policing as I once thought they were when I first started. And that really people's fear is about this alienation that they feel as racialized people, as Indigenous people, as working class people, as sex workers, people that are like constantly being cast out of society and feeling like they don't belong. And that creates, I think, space for us to work with. And it, is an opportunity for us to start building relationships and to help people realize just how much power we have when we organize and when we're united in our struggle and focus on the connections in our suffering more so than the differences between us.
It's the biggest challenge is to sort of awaken inside people what I think is always there. Like I always say, every person is an activist on the inside, right? And it's just we go into the world and we these notions that we have about trying to make the world a better place get squashed. We get shamed for thinking like that. We're not rewarded. And so it's really just trying to connect with people and to spark that little bit of passion they have inside and to help them develop the confidence that their voice matters and that they can change things. Because unfortunately they get the message, especially from the police, that you can't change things. And it's really disheartening. But no matter what challenges we're facing as we go through this work, we've met so many amazing people and continue to build relationships with new people. And so it makes the work so rewarding. And then what I struggle with is when people disclose being violently beaten by the police, being attacked by the police, being spat on by the police, having the police say to them, why don't you just go overdose and die? You know, I want to be able to stop that from happening like immediately. And that's not possible because we have to start with education and by working together.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of wanted to read this to you because it is just a small example of like, I don't know, just things that really motivate you to keep going, that they're hints that we're maybe on the right path. And it's a letter from a grade 11 high school student living in Surrey who wanted to reach out to someone living in Sanctuary Tent City after hearing that they were facing threat of displacement by bylaw. And, you know, after learning that sanctuary and that tent cities are a source of safety and belonging for a lot of homeless people. Here goes. To anyone who has ever felt that their voice has lost meaning due to oppression from the government and the police in whom we are conditioned to trust, I want you to know that your opinions and thoughts have value and have reached an 11th grade student living in the Guildford area. There are many families that could end up in your position with one missed paycheck. Always keep in mind and remember that your struggle is shared by thousands. Continue to stand your ground and remember that there are others standing with you. Remember that you are loved unconditionally. Never lose your sense of self-respect and dignity, because if you do that, then the people in power have won. Then they can control you. Don't let it come to that. Continue to be strong. And then the hashtag is Save Our Sanctuary, which is the hashtag that we have for those who are interested in following that struggle. So it's things like that. It's like examples of people feeling like another person's struggle resonates with them and seeing kind of the light flicker in people's eyes about this possibility of doing something about fighting that suffering. That's really what gets me going. And I think what gets a lot of us going.
Are there any stories you'd like to share about times when you've experienced that feeling of collective power with or as people terrorized by the police? And what are some of the moments that kind of stick in your mind?
The most recent example was last night when we had to go to a city hall meeting where there was a lot of people who were trying to stop the city hall from building supportive housing. I went to that just sort of thinking I was going to be in a supportive role and not really feeling comfortable speaking. And I was so overcome by the way people were speaking about homeless people. And sort of the what really disgusted me was people kept on saying, oh, you know, if you build this housing, there's going to be needles and we have children in this area. We have children in this area. And that really broke my heart because I have a 12-year-old daughter, and I started volunteering with the Alliance Against Displacement 6 years ago. So she's always been involved in my work. And I remember when she was six and she said to me, I took her to a tent city and there was an event on. And I remember she looked up at me and she said, you know what, mommy, homeless people are nice. Mm. And so what I get to see on an ongoing basis through apps and through the Alliance Against Displacement is that my daughter is interacting with people who are experiencing horrific forms of oppression and being really treated like they're less than human. And yet they're so kind to my daughter, and they're, in a sense, they're helping me raise her. They're contributing to her identity. They're contributing to her understanding of the world around her. And that just means so much to me as a parent that I see this person, this child of mine, and she is really a kind child. When she sees homeless people on the street, she doesn't act scared. I see in her that she has compassion and understanding. What I love is that she doesn't really act like she's seeing anything. It doesn't jar her to see like a homeless person, doesn't scare her. And at the same time, it also doesn't turn her into one of those people that like wants to sort of like baby homeless people and act like a benevolent person. But I see her acceptance. And it goes beyond just homeless people, but just in her life. So for me, there's been so many moments as a parent when I've been doing this work and I've watched my daughter have a moment with someone who was homeless or in particular an Indigenous person. And I've watched them sort of have a, just talk to her about something or talk to her about their culture and things like that and how that is contributing to making her the person she's becoming. And I think she's becoming just a phenomenal human being. And that I get so much out of that. And I wish more people could understand that or learn to see homeless people as members of the community that actually they contribute to our the wellness of our youth. And then again, like last night, I was very upset by everything I was hearing and I decided to get up and speak. And I was really stressed out and scared. So a person who was with me, an older man who's homeless, said to me, you know what, I'll come up and stand beside you. And that just meant so much to me to have that moment of supporting each other and of feeling like I, you know, it was very personal to me what I was hearing because members of my family passed away on the street homeless. And that in this moment, this person who himself is homeless and is just struggling under really unfair conditions was supporting me. And we were supporting each other. And that was so meaningful to me. And it's those types of experiences that propel me forward. It makes it much better than doing something like just going to a barbecue and sitting around and talking with my friends. I would rather be at a community event with people who share my struggle for different reasons.
One experience that comes up for me happened last week, again with high school students during one of the workshops that I was helping co-facilitate. What was it that we were talking about? We were talking about our experiences with policing, and everyone in the room, with like maybe a couple people being white, were racialized. And like we were kind of touching on a bit, South Asian people in Surrey are one of the most heavily policed. And it was really powerful for me to hear young people who were about 16, 17, maybe some 18-year-olds talking about how we don't need the police. And they were relating what it felt like to be policed and how they feel around the police back to like what impact that has on their sense of community. And it was just like really inspiring, honestly, to hear a group of people who've maybe never talked about this together form all of these connections about just how repressive the police are and that we really don't need them. And as a racialized person, we're constantly made to feel small. We're constantly inferiorized in order to uphold whiteness and white supremacy. And so for that to happen and just unfold organically is huge. And it's kind of rare. And yeah, I mean, it's something that I think happens quite often in these spaces that we create even for just a couple of hours. But it's inspiring, I think, for at least a couple of people. And that's enough.
And this is, I guess, touching on what some of those youth were saying, but the way I see it, I guess, police and courts and prisons, part of what they do is dispossess us of our ability to deal with conflict in our own lives and communities and defend ourselves and address harm. I guess I'm curious, do you see part of building anti-police power in Surrey as in part being about developing people's capacities or developing alternative methods of taking care of each other without the police? And what do you think that could look like?
Yeah, I think APPS, again, it's an organization that's only a year old, but like one of our ambitions is to help communities in Surrey develop the capacity to look at ways to deal with crime and interpersonal conflict. I know that we just had a member join, we just had someone who just joined APPS who is really excited about bringing in a program that he experienced in another city called the Buddy System, where what happens is instead of having the police come like break up conflicts at parties that teenagers throw, is to develop a system where that there can be a buddy at a party that doesn't drink that night and is there to make sure that things kind of go smoothly if they get out of hand, so the police don't end up being called. So it's going to start with like smaller things like that. But again, woven into that too is developing within people a consciousness that what we consider crime, the vast majority of what we consider crime, is really the result of our capitalist system, because it's the result of poverty, right? So again, it's about hopefully building a consciousness around not just an abolition of the police, but an abolition of laws that criminalize people, like drug laws and things like that. So it's more aspirational at this point, but we are only a year old.
I guess just to end off, was there anything that I haven't asked you that you wish I had, or anything that you wanted to talk about?
One of the things that I forgot to start off with, that I want to emphasize as really important in our work, are the anti-colonial politics and the fact that we are active on the unceded, meaning never surrendered and stolen territories of the Simiyamu, Tsawwassen, Kikait, Keitsi, Kukwutlem, and Kwantlen nations. And that a big part of our work is making sure that we don't subsume anti-colonial struggle within like a class reductionist kind of politics, and figuring out what it means to talk about like displacement of homeless people on stolen territory. That has to be a really essential aspect of our organizing work. And also want to just quickly plug that anyone who's interested in coming to an APPS meeting is more than welcome to. Like I said, we meet every other Sunday from 3 to 5 p.m. in Wally. So if you're interested in reaching out to us, we have some contact information that we can share, if that's okay.
Yeah, go for it.
So our handle on Instagram is anti-police power. You can find us on Facebook by typing in anti-police power Surrey. And you can also send us an email by emailing antipolicepower@gmail.com. And I just want to bring this up because it's something that happened in Surrey, but which is a much broader concern, of course. And it was that in September 2018, there was an Indigenous trans woman named Hayden Patterson who has been held at the Alouette, or sorry, since then, she's been held at the Alouette Correctional Center for Women. And is awaiting extradition into the United States on a murder charge for an act of self-defense against the man who attempted to sexually assault her. And before she was transferred over to the Alouette Correctional Center, she was at a prison in Surrey, where she was being denied foods that were kosher, and she's Jewish, and so she's been. She's filed two human rights complaints, one against Alouette, I believe. Yeah, one against Alouette for forcing her to sign paperwork where she basically has to demonstrate her gender expression that is consistent with her current gender identity as a woman, and being forced to live in isolation without a cellmate, despite the fact that other people, like other women in the jail, were willing to do so. And another against the Surrey Detention Center. So it was the Surrey Pretrial Services Center, where she was discriminated against based on her religion. And we just wanted to bring that out there because the Surrey hearing, I think, is expected for the fall. And it's just one example of so many of how absurd the correctionals or the prison system is, in that you have an Indigenous woman who's being extradited across borders, across colonial borders for self-defense, essentially, and is, as a trans woman, is being denied or being forced to adhere rigidly to what it means to be quote unquote female, and to a way higher standard than any other cis woman would feasibly be expected to do. And so if we wanted to just kind of bring that up as something that's impacted Surrey, but also if people are interested in maybe organizing support for something like this, to please reach out to us.
You've been listening to From Embers on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Or perhaps you've been listening to the podcast version, which you can find online at fromembers.libsyn.com or by searching for From Embers wherever you get your podcasts. If you have any questions or feedback for us, we'd love to hear from you. Email fromembers@riseup.net. See you next week.
Join us for KiteLine, a weekly radio program on Channel Zero Network that focuses on issues in the prison system. With over 50 episodes already released, you can hear informative and riveting stories about the impact of prisons on people both inside and outside of the prison walls, and how they fight back.
KiteLine is intended as means of communication between people across prison walls. Our goal at KiteLine is to amplify the voices of those within the prison system while encouraging dialogue with those on the outside.
Hear us on the Channel Zero Network and visit our website for more information or previous episodes at kitelineradio.noblogs.org.